Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the GeoMob Podcast. Today, I have as my guest Chris Beto. He is the author of the World Builder Newsletter, which, as the tagline describes, is a newsletter about building the virtual Earth, OpenStreetMap, and the parallel reality of geospace. So I am a longtime subscriber to this newsletter, and it's always quite thought-provoking. Chris is also a longtime member of the OpenStreetMap community, and he has a lot of insights to share. And so let's dive right in. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for hosting me.
Thanks for coming. Tell us about yourself. What's your background in geospatial? What is this, a hobby? It's a job. Give us all of your story.
Yeah. So I think the reason I got into geospatial is probably the reason for a lot of decisions I made in life, which was I wanted an excuse to think about the world. I don't think people travel by default by working in GIS, but to me, it's like at least when you can look at the map and get ideas and think about that every day, I think that's really inspiring. So I studied political science as a student in university, as well as Arabic and Middle Eastern studies. And I was training to be an army officer at the time. So I spent 4 years in the army.
U.S. Army.
Yep, U.S. Army. Yeah, I lived out by Seattle. I didn't do really much of anything at all. A lot of time out in the rain. And it was very boring. And yeah, I think my original expectation was like, hey, I'm going to study languages and go see the world, and it'll be interesting for better or worse. But the worst thing is it was just very boring. But I did use a lot of map systems, and you get these kind of clunky older ones that were used inside of a Humvee or on your computer for planning out like training in the forest. And I started to wonder, how are these made? And sometimes, why are they made so poorly? How could it be better? And I stumbled upon the term GIS. I think there were some people in like one office near me who were these geospatial engineers that got to print out the maps for training use. And that led me to do a master's. So I started that while I was in the Army, did a master's at University of Washington, and then finished it just after I left the Army. And that became my route of like, hey, I want to actually get out there in the world, get some hands-on on building maps, collecting data, and ideally meeting that international community that I really quickly learned about.
And then what brought you into OpenStreetMap? When was this all happening? Like, was this before OpenStreetMap or in the early days of OpenStreetMap?
Yeah, it was, I think it was my first year as a master's student. There was a small introduction to OpenStreetMap. It was kind of a footnote with a lot of other stuff that was kind of Esri-focused, a bit of Python. And I can always see on my OpenStreetMap account that my first edit was right near where I lived in Tacoma, Washington. Just, I'm not sure, fixing a street. And it was small at the time. I thought, okay, that's interesting. I don't know how useful that is as a job skill. And it came back after I'd finished my studies and I worked for Mapillary. And with Mapillary, there was suddenly a very big overlap in communities.
How did you end up at Mapillary? You just randomly applied there? Or how did you know to...
Yeah. It was a summer where I was doing an internship, and that was based on satellite imagery and a little more academic. And I was like, yeah, it's interesting. But I was reading through, I think, Forbes, and they had this list of, I think it was just startups to watch. It might have been map focused. And Mapillary was one of the names there. So I had emailed to just like the hello at Mapillary address, wow, introduced myself and said, yeah, I'm interested. I wanted to see if you have a chat. I don't know.
This was before Mapillary was acquired by Facebook or after?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is 2015, no, 16.
Okay, right.
Okay. Yeah. So that's 4 years before the acquisition. And I came on as, I think I was the first person with a pure geospatial focus at Mapillary. Not an engineer, not building the infrastructure, not really doing the marketing and partnerships. So they said it's time we had somebody that would really help us plug into the GIS field. And I was really lucky to be there at the right place and right time.
Yeah, I'm sure that was an amazing ride. So, and then you stayed there through the Facebook acquisition. Is that how you currently work at Facebook or Meta? Is that how the process went?
Yeah, exactly. So I think around sometime mid earlier 2020, we got an announcement of like, guess what? Acquisition's happening, so we're joining Facebook. And there was a few weeks of a bit of chaos figuring out what happens next. What does your job role change into? But rode through that storm. And then I think summer 2020, all of us that came over from Legacy Mapillary joined into the Maps team at Meta.
Okay, well, I'm sure that was an exciting journey. So, and then what prompted this newsletter? How long have you been doing world building?
So I think I started this, it's probably like 6 months after the Meta acquisition. So it was really, I think it was the end of 2020 or start of 2021. And I think the first time I wrote it, I was like alone in a cabin in the woods during remote work of COVID times, and I just had a lot of ideas about things I had seen working with Mapillary from a startup perspective, things you're exposed to suddenly with this huge research and development group inside of Meta. And I wanted to write these down and put them out to an audience. So I said, I'm going to start a Substack.
And so what was the goal? It was just to get the thoughts out of your head, or was it to generate feedback from others? Or, I mean, a lot of people have interesting observations, or that doesn't mean they start a newsletter. So what made you take that step?
I mean, fundamentally, I've just always really been interested in writing. I've loved to just write, often without really planning ahead what I'm going to do. I just let it flow. So typically in the past, that was something like travel writing, nothing really technical. So I think at this point I said, I feel like I'm getting ideas of, hey, why don't we do this better in terms of geospatial, in terms of different apps, or how could it be done differently? And I said, I don't want to just write this down in a diary. I would like an audience to start a discussion. At this time, a lot of the geospatial community was on Twitter, for example, and you get 250 characters there and stuff would happen. But I said, I have more that I want to write down in a structured way and just put out there. And then maybe it turns into something in the future too. I found that the first time I published something on the World Builder newsletter, it just generated a ton of discussion, especially in comments on social media and people reaching out to me to follow up. And I said, wow, it makes the world a lot more talkative, spread around.
Yeah, I find a very similar thing here with the podcast. It just creates a lot more serendipity, of course, because then people contact you. You made one point there. You said you wanted to write something that was not very technical. And actually, this is one of the things I like best about your newsletter, is that obviously you address technical themes or whatever, but it doesn't get lost in the technical minutiae. And this is one thing I have to say that a lot of people in geospatial get too hung up on, particularly, let's say, in the OpenStreetMap world and things. And maybe it's just the nature of the medium on social media with limited space or whatever. But I find very quickly people get too transfixed on this certain technology or that technology or whatever. And all of that is, especially now as we celebrate 20 years of OpenStreetMap, all of that is very transient. The technologies come and go, right? But what stays is how people interact with the map, or let's say the geospatial database, and how we try to build services that help people achieve the actual goals that they're trying to deal with. And I'm sure actually in the space you're most familiar with Mapillary, that the technology has in the last 10 years has probably changed so much as to how Street View is being captured and what we can do with the pictures, and that's before we even get into all the machine learning and AI analysis of the pictures and things like that. So, I mean, this is one of the main reasons I love the newsletter and why I think everyone should subscribe, because it helps you kind of come up for air out of the nitty gritty detailed discussion that it's so easy to get lost in. And instead think about the bigger themes. So, I mean, is that kind of an intentional choice of yours, or is that just the nature of your work? Or
I think I used to write I still do once in a while, some of the Mapillary blog posts.
All right. Okay.
Those are fun, but a lot of them are this very like, hey, we're just announcing a new product. We're going to give you some background.
Right.
And it's helpful to read as a reader. Like, it introduces you to something and you get the gist of it, and then you can go follow up on it. As the person writing it, I think it can be kind of a drag. Maybe it's really natural for others. But we got this new head of marketing at Mapillary at one point, 2018 or something, and she was incredible at saying like, hey, we need to do more storytelling. And I think that actually is what woke this up in me, is I was like, hey, I think there's so much stuff. I have so many tabs open all the time still of stuff I want to read about geospatial or related programming things. And it's hard to get through it. It feels like I have a syllabus of coursework that I have to do.
Completely true. I mean, everyone I know has 100 open tabs, right? And you can't possibly consume all the information.
Yeah. Many stay open for months or years. But to me, I said, you know, it's a relief for me to just kind of put a spin of creative writing on talking about geospatial. And I think it's sort of it intends to be kind of a treat for readers as well. It's like, here's something that you don't have to start thinking about what you're going to do with this to implement in QGIS or something like that. It's too much work, right? Like a talking shop. It's like, let's open up the imagination a little more. Talk about something that we might talk about, you know, at a conference over drinks, and it goes in a nice, more creative direction.
So how do you find your topics, or how do you choose your topics? Just let inspiration strike, or is it kind of more deliberate? Or
yeah, a lot of them just start to hit me. I just email myself a topic and sometimes some links. Some of them are something I'm very curious about, so as I do the research, I just kind of log what I find out and then add my commentary. And yeah, that's pretty much it. There's nothing that's super,
How long does it typically take? Because actually one thing that is noticeable is that in many cases you can, as a reader, it's easy to tell that the pieces are well-researched. I mean, you have all kinds of images and things, and it's clear this isn't just something you dashed off on your phone while you were waiting for the bus or something. It's a bit more crafted.
They often start that way. So, I mean, sometimes I aim to do it in under 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
That never really works out. Like, I sit down at 7 p.m. and then it's midnight and I'm finishing. But I like to do it in one sitting, though, because something hits a flow and I'm really interested in the topic, and I just don't like to pause and have to come back to it a few days later. So I often have, you know, weeks, and sometimes there's been months between publishing something, just because I'm waiting to get a block of time as well as that spark to do it in one go. So that's the combination of it. But there's a few of them once in a while where I'll slowly take notes, but I won't start the writing until I've piled up a whole bunch of emails or chat notes to myself.
What are kind of the broad topics that you're most interested in?
I think the biggest one for me overall is just this very, very broad idea of what is the future of maps. And it's often from an experience of consumer maps, and I would say user experience. So I'm not so interested in talking about what GIS work looks like. I think there's always a future to it, but it's just tools evolving. But I'm always fascinated by how people, you know, walk around with road atlases or drive around with those and walk around with a city map and paper, and then it evolves to a mobile phone. And what's next? Or like, have we hit some kind of peak and plateau? I'm not sure.
Well, it is fascinating. You know, I really do think we underestimate, or we aren't able to process just how much things have changed in the last 30 years. You know, I see it with my kids, you know, and how they, for better and worse. I mean, it used to be, I mean, this is crazy, man. But I remember when I moved to London in 2005, everyone in London carried around a little book, the A to Z, full of maps. Everyone.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, people would look up all the time and, you know, it'd be, you'd have to ask directions more and you'd have to, you know, it wasn't immediately clear. How would I find out the opening hours for a store or whatever? You'd have to call them up or, and we forget how rapidly, how recently that was.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And I don't know. The thing that's fascinating for me is I feel like, you know, they say when the internet started, you know, step one was like, okay, we're going to take all the things that used to be in the newspaper and we used to print them on the newspaper once a day. And now we're going to stick them on a website. And okay, then you can make search and you can do all these things. But it took kind of a, let's say 10 years or whatever before people start coming up with truly new concepts, right? The old concept was just, let's do the old things and do them on the computer. And the same thing kind of with the maps, right? And it used to be, okay, we carry around the A to Z and now I'm going to stick the map on the web page or, and you can browse the map or whatever. And now it feels like for the first time we're starting to come up with actually truly different services that couldn't exist in a non-digital world, right? It's not just about making it faster and, you know, the database is infinite and things like that. But, you know, now we're starting to truly take advantage of the fact that everyone has this tracking device on them all the time. And I really think that's a generational cultural thing. Like you have to, the people who lived in the old model, it's almost like they don't have the mental freedom to invent the new model, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an in-between generation too, I think, that's interesting. Like, my little brother's, I think he 25 or something like this. So I'm 10 years older. And he's young enough to, yeah, I think he was born before Google Maps, but started, never has like memories of Google Maps not existing. Around that time that he maybe would like use his first device, I remember using MapQuest on like a Motorola, what were those, Razor phone, which was like really not compatible for that, but I managed to get it in a browser that, yeah, it was kind of cutting edge and too slow. But there was this tolerance for trying new things that didn't work that well. And then I think somebody, you know, like my dad or like my neighbor that lives here who asks me for computer help sometimes, she's 80 years old about it, they have a mindset of like, I've already established how I use these tools. I know what I like. I'm not really interested in thinking about or working with something new and experimental.
Sure. I mean, unfortunately, I find as I get older, I just think it's human nature. You just can't escape. You move more and more to the model of let me do it the tried and true way that I know how it works. And, you know, I don't want to learn a new way and I don't trust the new way. And it's very difficult to escape that mindset.
Yeah. I mean, I think cognitively with maps, we're still in a pattern that's probably millennia old. I mean, I think it's interesting about the design of any maps on mobile. It's the user experience generally is still like the paper map where you have a flat surface. You kind of expect north and south or certain directions.
Yeah.
Search is a new thing. Like there's some things embedded in there, but you've essentially digitalized the piece of paper. And what I think would be a bit mind blowing is how could you approach this kind of spatial awareness or discovery of what's around you or looking for directions from something that's entirely cognitively different. And that's something that probably people alive today would find uncomfortable to change into in the future if something like that ever arrives.
Well, I mean, also all the aspects around privacy and things like that are very, you know, scary, you know, unintuitive, you know, you know, like, for example, you know, as I have a son, he's 14. Should I be able to always know where my son is? That seems absurd, all right? No time in history was that the case. And yet I know many parents who are like, of course, I need to know where my kid is all the time.
Yeah.
You know? So, I don't know. It raises a lot of questions about what can we do? What should we do? What's possible? That I think we as a society need to have more and more discussions about. I mean, obviously there are so many aspects of privacy as well, not just in geospatial, but anyway, what are the things that have you most excited? What technologies or what kind of trends or as we look forward?
You know, I think in a more practical sense, something I'm hoping to write about soon that I've been reading a lot about is use of different tools like LIDAR and ground penetrating radar in archaeology and anthropology, even just study of deep history. So I've followed how there's, you know, new structures being found in Guatemala, in the Amazon, in Brazil. I think they had some also in places like Cambodia. It's really interesting because I think there's a lot of lost knowledge about not just the natural physical geography of the earth. I mean, there's some cool stuff like here in the Zurich ETH, they found something about how the plates under the Pacific Ocean work in very unexpected ways they haven't solved yet, thanks to some new methods of measuring that. But even from the human and built environment perspective, we don't know a lot about who was living in the Amazon a couple thousand years ago. And it's turned out it's probably a lot of people and something really interesting culturally. So it's cool that these really advanced tools can help us where people hacking through the jungle with machetes just couldn't still find anything. It's just too big, too vast, too difficult. So that's definitely a topic I want to look into. In general, I overall like in this broad area, just finding, I guess you'd call this cross-pollination of technologies or fields. So, you know, people say they design a house and it's based on the way that bees design a hive. So not exactly that, but things are relatively that direction. And with geospatial spreading into other fields, I like into finding everything. Those use cases.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other way too, what comes into geospatial from other fields? I mean, AI very much has.
Well, this is one of the themes that we see again and again at GeoMob, at the talks or on the podcast, is that, you know, the cost of knowing where something is has fallen so completely that, you know, pretty soon you'll always be able to know where everything is, right? And so what possibility does that open up? And, or as I said before, should we be able to know where everything is at all the time? Or you can, you know, what, yeah, I mean, so, but what, one thing that's interesting about your answer there, talking about, you know, the LIDAR and things like this, I assume this is, I don't know exactly what your day-to-day role is at Meta in the map group there, but I'm going to guess it's not, you know, looking at Amazonian civilizations or things like that. So to what extent is the newsletter prompted by topics that you explore in your day-to-day, you know, practical work, or is it just, it seems like it's a much more kind of, I don't want to say whimsical, but kind of, you know, drawn from all kinds of other sources.
Yeah, I mean, probably a third of it comes from work. And, you know, a lot of what I see at work is, I don't know, sometimes I say I crunch numbers. I like to call it computational geometry a lot. So, yeah, I don't get a look at the Amazon, but probably very similar skills of taking data sets like mapillaries, street imagery or LIDAR imagery, figuring out, you know, what can we derive from this? How can we make new data? How can we figure out exactly where things in photos are located in order to then put that into a base map? So a lot of that coming up with methods of mostly creating new data, I would say. And the reason I do a lot of that is it feeds into these bigger projects at Meta. And I think one of the hot topics that I'm often connecting to, not super directly, but always as like, if you keep asking why, like, why are we working on this and what does that feed into and why that? I think a lot of it is augmented reality. And I think about augmented reality is many people might not realize how it's very, very, very inherently spatial. It can involve indoors. It can involve cameras and sensing what's far and near, identifying things automatically. A ton of challenges, a ton of very new experimental technologies. But there's also this very, very foundational layer of you just need a map. You need to know if there's a building here, if there's a road there, and like POIs, things like this. So to me, it's supporting this long-term goal of making the world just a lot better mapped and in a different way. I don't know if you'd say three-dimensional, but I would say also kind of micro, or I don't want to say HD, but just comprehensive.
Not a small task.
No, and a never-ending task. never-ending.
Very nice, Chris. I as the listeners can hopefully appreciate, there's a lot to think about and a lot of different topics. So I really do encourage everyone to subscribe to the newsletter and be stimulated by your regular posts. Nevertheless, while you're here, because you work at Meta, and I clearly I know you don't speak for Meta, and I'm not asking you to comment on Meta's products or policies or anything, but I'm wondering if you can give the listeners any insight into some of the challenges of just working in one of these huge mapping teams that are building interfaces for literally billions of people. And I ask this because I started my career quite a long time ago working at Yahoo when it was one of the biggest internet brands. And very often we would get kind of feedback from people, and it was clear they just had no concept of the challenges we were facing and the day-to-day pressures that we had at when you operate at just the mega scale. And you try to serve all audiences. And sometimes I do feel like often when I see commentary in the open, particularly in the OpenStreetMap community, unfortunately, often criticizing not just Meta, but let's say all the big geospatial brands that consumers interact with. And I feel like many people just can't appreciate the perspective. If you haven't been inside one of these big machines, you just can't get it. And so maybe you could share a little bit about your experience there and what it's like working on maps that are going to be seen by billions of people in all kinds of different parts of the world and all these kinds of things. Share a little of your perspective.
Yeah. I think so. One thing that's key to keep in mind, I think, about maps at Meta, it's an R&D project. It's inside of Reality Labs. So it's a bit separate from the what we call family of apps. So it's like WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram.
All right, okay.
So that's really cool because from there, Maps is quite a deeper project than only putting display into the apps. But at the same time, there's this bit of separation. So Instagram's its own product. It has, to me, what feels like it's entirely other company running it, basically. It's people I've never met, maybe we'll come across, but they do need maps. And sometimes that's a design kind of approach. So it's, we want a base map, and what's most important is, choosing the styling and the colors. But it's often a data decision. It's like, what kind of stuff do you need in the map? Does it exist already? Do you want to filter some things out and not show it? Or what's missing? What else can you add? So there's this, I think of it almost like you're working for a consultancy that specializes in taking a lot of map data that does exist. OpenStreetMap, Overture, which is built on and uses, I think, mostly OpenStreetMap for the basis and pulls in other data sets. And you have all this open data from county and city and national GIS agencies. And you're tailoring that to the use case of these consumer-facing products to help them display what they need. So it's probably very similar to some people that work in smaller consultancies for that. But at the same time, you get to see these long roadmaps and figure out, not just like the immediate need, like fulfilling something in the next 6 months, but you you see the direction that all things are going and you try to plan and work toward that. So yeah, I think from what you can't see from the outside, that's interesting is just thinking about things like 5-year timelines. And a lot of that's what inspires me to write sometimes, where it's stuff that is not really relevant for me to share around internally at work. I'm not a big influencer on the roadmap of 5 years, like people who've been at it way longer and are way more up the hierarchy than me. But I have ideas that I want to share about, you know, how I would do it, how I would approach it. So I like to write those down in my own way.
Well, very nice. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. Cause as I said, I do encourage everyone to subscribe to the newsletter. I find it quite stimulating. It's not particularly high volume, which I frankly also enjoy in that, as we said, there's enough information. But it's just enough that it's always refreshing and it gives me something new to contemplate. So I do appreciate it. And hopefully we'll get you along to a GeoMob event at some point. I don't know. You're based in Switzerland, right? So I guess your nearest one might be Berlin, or I guess maybe Barcelona, or if you want to pop up to London or something. Anyway,
yeah, it might happen.
Anyway, at some point, hopefully we'll get you to speak at an event as well. So, if people want to learn more, Chris, how can they get in touch with you? What's the best way?
I think. Yeah, my best social connection these days seems to be LinkedIn. So you can find me there. You've got the World Builder newsletter. You can go to worldbuilder.substack.com. I still check Twitter sometimes. You can search my handle, CBED. That's Charlie Bravo Echo Delta 32. And I think it's the same on Blue Sky and Mastodon. So I check into all those and comment in a flurry sometimes. So I like hearing from people and all that.
Well, we'll make sure we get some of those in the show notes so that people can get in touch with you. Thanks very much, Chris.
Yeah, Appreciate it. Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.